The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And in this corner, weighing in with his take on current events, the smarty of the party, the mighty Mike from the right, the heavyweight of debate, the man who's in cahoots with the grassroots, the broadcaster master, Jimmy Sangenberger.
Saturday night is always all right for the Jimmy Sangenberger Show right here on News Talk 710 KNUS. So great to be with you once again. A pleasure and a privilege indeed. If you want to join into the festivities 24/7, 365, a few different ways to do that. You can, of course, tweet at me at Sang Center. That's Sang with an E. Not an A, center on Twitter. You can also email me. Two different ways to do that. Via the 710KNUS website, 710KNUS.com. If you just go to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show page, where you can access podcasts for the program, and email me. Plus, go ahead and email me via JimmySangenberger.com and the contact page there. Remember, there's no A, there's no I, there's no U in Sangenberger. It's all E's all the time. Once you know that, Sangenberger is easy. So great to be with you once again here, 5 to 8 p.m. on good old 710 KNUS. A lot we're going to do tonight. Among the array of guests, we've got former ambassador to Bahrain, Sam Zakim, who's joining me along with Samuel Laurie of the Centennial Institute to break down the historic achievement this week by President Trump and his administration of helping to broker peace between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. It's remarkable. Truly is historic. Gordon G. Chang, of course, noted China critic, somebody always on Fox. He's got a recent book that he released, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Talking with him, of course, about the latest developments out of China, which are deeply disturbing in many respects. Allie Beth Stuckey, she's host of the Blaze podcast, Relatable, has a new book out called You Aren't Enough and That's Okay. I talked with her on Jimmy at the Crossroads this past week, my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, about her book and how its themes really fit into the broader mosaic of the chaos we're seeing ensue across the country. So we'll share that interview. Michael Fields from Colorado Rising Action. Want to make sure you can appropriately hear the full interview with Michael about Senator Cory Gardner's race versus John Hickenlooper, how Hickenlooper seems to be flopping all over the place. Plus the ballot initiatives that are making some real headway. Looks like we've got some great things going on to the ballot this November. Very proactive, which is encouraging. So we got all that and so much more coming up. But first, I want to give some thoughts tonight on Joe Biden's selection of Kamala Harris. She won the Veep Stakes. The senator from California, phony Kamala. As a Trump campaign ad put it, she won the Veep Stakes. Joe Biden selected her. To me, that's no surprise. In fact, I was getting surprised that there were other possible selections that were really making notable headway, or at least seemed to be. But I'm not surprised that Harris was the selection. So to kind of kick off my thoughts on the Harris selection by Joe Biden, I want to first play the ad that was released immediately by the Trump campaign blasting Kamala Harris as a potential vice president. Take a listen to the ad, and then I'll share some thoughts that you may not have considered about Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris ran for president by rushing to the radical left, embracing Bernie's plan for socialized medicine, calling for trillions in new taxes, attacking Joe Biden for racist policies. Voters rejected Harris. They smartly spotted a phony. But not Joe Biden. He's not that smart. Biden calls himself a transition candidate. He is handing over the reins to Kamala while they jointly embrace the radical left. Slow Joe and phony Kamala. Perfect together. Wrong for America.
Just a couple of quick initial thoughts on the Kamala Harris pick. Number one, it is not surprising at all that Joe Biden made this selection. I was getting surprised that he was looking closely, it seemed, at Gretchen Whitmer, the horrid governor of Michigan. I was getting surprised that there was so much talk about Susan Rice, former national security advisor to President Barack Obama. Now, Kamala Harris was the most predictable and obvious choice imaginable, and it's exactly what ended up happening. Now, what the Trump campaign is going to have to highlight are the ways in which he is stronger than her on criminal justice reform. We saw the way she went toe-to-toe with Tulsi Gabbard.
I want to bring the conversation back to the broken criminal justice system that is disproportionately negatively impacting Black and brown people all across this country today. Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way.
Thank you, Congresswoman. Senator Harris, your response.
As the elected Attorney General of California, I did the work of significantly reforming the criminal justice system of a state of 40 million people, which became a national model for the work that needs to be done. And I am proud of that work. And I am proud of making a decision to not just give fancy speeches or be in a legislative body and give speeches on the floor, but actually doing the work of being in the position to use the power that I had to reform a system that is badly in need of reform. That is why we created initiatives that were about reentering former offenders and getting them counseling. It is why, and because I know that criminal justice system is
Senator.
So broken, that I am an advocate for what
Thank
we need
Senator.
To do to not
your
only decriminalize, but legalize marijuana in the United States.
I want to bring Congresswoman Gabbard back in. Your response?
The bottom line is, Senator Harris, when you are in a position to make a difference and an impact in these people's lives, you did not. And worse yet, in the case of those who were on death row, innocent people, you actually blocked evidence from being revealed that would have freed them until you were forced to do so. There is no excuse for that. And the people who suffered under your reign as prosecutor, you owe them an apology.
Gabbard just absolutely, I would say it was, you know, that hyperbolic destroyed, so-and-so destroys this person. It was basically that kind of moment with a congresswoman from Hawaii really taking it to the senator from California on criminal justice issues in a way that appeals to the Democratic base. President Trump really should highlight the criminal justice reform gains that he has taken while also underscoring no to defunding police, no to taking a lot of these extreme steps that the far left wants to see Joe Biden and other Democrats embark on. Also, when it comes to Biden and Harris, bringing them together, they do have that baggage. You cannot avoid it. Of the two of them challenging one another, and particularly Harris, surprising a lot of people at the time, a lot of analysts were struck by the manner in which Kamala Harris took these swipes at Joe Biden over comments in the 1970s related to busing.
It's personal, and I was actually it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
She seemed, you know, come across as this very empathetic person. And she showed that here in a way that was like trying to build empathy from the audience. Joe Biden, you really hurt me. You hurt me with your comments. Now she's like, ah, that's all water under the bridge. I'm not too worried about that. That's just Joe Biden, you know, whatever. Now we're partners. Now we're the ticket. That's just the primary. That's behind us. But Harris cannot simply avoid that. The problem, number one problem that Kamala Harris, I think, is going to have to deal with in the Biden campaign is that moniker that the Trump campaign gave in the ad, Phony Harris. Phony Harris. Slow Joe, Phony Harris. Senator Harris is known, I think, in recent months and last year especially, for feigning passion pretty well, but feigning it nonetheless. That is to say, she's not authentic. She comes across as a deeply inauthentic individual when she is not scripted in these moments where she's really planned it out. Let me go ahead and touch people's hearts, pull on those heartstrings. When she's not pre-planned in that circumstance, she comes across as phony or something relative to that, something similar to phony. And I think that's going to be the challenge from the Biden campaign, is presenting Kamala Harris as somebody who could meet this moment in terms of some of the criminal justice reform issues enough to bring on board the leftist base that is not, honestly, not too pleased about Senator Harris. They have deep reservations about her and what she brings to the table. But also at the same time, she's got to placate moderates who are looking at the Democratic Party right now and saying, I'm not too sure I'm on board with your radicalism on policing and so forth. So there's this interesting fine line that they're going to have to walk in that regard, but also in terms of authenticity, really trying to make her seem like she's not somebody who has always been looking at the next rung on the political ladder. And she's going to have to deal with these claims that she was leveling against Joe Biden. There was this one article. She did an interview with the Huffington Post. Headline, Kamala Harris on Joe Biden accusers. I believe them. Some of these things, especially in the Me Too moment, especially in the Black Lives Matter moment, some of these things that she has said in the past against Joe Biden will not easily and quickly go away. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Trump campaign will not allow them to quickly go away. So if you're a Republican, I think you'd be pretty bullish. You should be pretty bullish about this selection of Kamala Harris, not energizing the left-wing base, but also providing some strong lines of attack and criticism from the Trump campaign. But at the same time, cannot rest on your laurels in any way, stretch, or form. Need to make sure that you're effective in your messaging and that you're not letting things slide, that you don't look at polls and see a trend that maybe President Trump is starting to regain some lost ground and say, oh, we're getting this in the bag. We don't have to worry so much. Not an election for either side, really, to underestimate the other side. So it is going to be interesting to see how this all unfolds. And also eventually when we get to a Pence-Harris debate, how that is going to look, especially since Pence is much more of a mild-mannered guy than Donald Trump. These debates are going to be quite riveting television. must watch to be sure. All in all, if you're a Republican, I think you'd be happy, should be happy about the selection of Kamala Harris. If you're on the far left, you're probably not so thrilled because of some of her criminal justice record and some other points. If you are a liberal Democrat, relatively progressive Democrat, you're probably pretty darn thrilled. I've got a few more thoughts on Kamala Harris and the "you're probably pretty darn thrilled." I've got some more thoughts on the political dynamics of this 2020 election cycle that I'll share in a moment. But first, let's enjoy a nice bonus bumper reminding us that we must indeed be careful how we vote from the great Walter Trout. Yes, folks, just as Mr. Walter Trout sings, we must indeed be careful how we vote, especially as we are getting closer and closer to the election. Once again, you're listening to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. Really getting down to a matter of weeks before ballots start dropping, which is crazy. If you think about it, we're already just about there. Truly stunning. But alas, here we are. So there are a couple of things I want to wrap up this segment talking about that relate to one of the big debates going on in the country right now, and that is over vote by mail. And this system that's set up right now in Colorado versus what they're trying to replicate in other states around the country, what the Democrats are advocating for in other states around the country. They want, in particular, what Pelosi wants in the House bill is to strip away signature verification requirements. That's the biggest problem with the House bill. Signature verification is one of the things that brings about greater election integrity in our system in Colorado, which, let's be honest here, it works. With a few exceptions that can come about, especially when you have an incompetent partisan election official like, I don't know, license plate tag clerk of Arapahoe County, Joan Lopez, or Secretary of State Jenna Griswold, there could be some problems that come from that. But by and large, we have a system that is tried and true, that works well, that has been successful, and that is a model other states can use. But the problem, as I've talked about before, and I discussed on my web show, Jimmy at the Crossroads, yesterday with Wayne Williams, former Secretary of State for Colorado, and Matt Crane, former county clerk for Arapahoe County, the problem is rushing this system into place around the country. The idea of just funneling money to the post office, which is already bleeding dollars all the time, that is somehow going to be a panacea to make mail balloting work and make it great, solve all these problems, and that President Trump is singularly the villain for mail ballot chaos that can ensue if they don't get enough money into the post office, is nonsense. Democrats, by the way, are all up in arms over President Trump saying this over the week in which he... Well, just take a listen for yourself.
Now, they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting. If we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they can't have universal mail-in voting.
Now, that's not good messaging on the part of President Trump to tie a desire not to provide additional funding for the post office directly to the idea of mail voting. But there's more to it than meets the eye, but it just provides, the way in which he phrased that, provides fodder to the Democrats. The reality is that the post office is bleeding money, as I said, and giving more money to the post office isn't going to solve all the plethora of issues that exist if you rush to a mail ballot system. Here in Colorado, we have drop boxes. Those drop boxes are being monitored at all times by cameras at every drop box. There's signature verification with voter ID for your first-time voters. There's the opportunity, if there's an issue with your signature, to have a second go at it to get a correction. If you don't receive your ballot, you can actually go vote in person. There are a number of different things in place that Colorado has, and simply replicating these, or simply thinking you can easily replicate these in a very short span of time, just if you have some money thrown at it, is nonsensical. The facts don't jibe with that idea, which is why, while the Democrats are right that in states like Colorado, where vote by mail is in effect and has been for years, it works well, they're wrong to basically extrapolate from an experience like we've had and to stretch it out and say, oh, this is emblematic of all vote by mail systems. And therefore, President Trump is wrong in all of his complaints and all of his gripes. And he's just trying to sabotage a system that has worked in some states and should just be replicated in every other state. That's what's really going on here. We need to make sure that we're educating especially moderate friends who are up for grabs, who may be open to voting for President Trump but haven't made their mind up yet. We need to make sure that they understand what is really going on here and not just what the media is presenting as the case and not what President Trump is allowing the media sometimes with some of his word choices to perpetuate. All right, we're just getting started, revved up and ready to go. Five more segments yet to come here on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show. You're listening to News Talk 710 KNUS. Don't go anywhere.
Bottoms.
Coming back on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. You know, this tune is called The Fall of the Peacemakers by the classic rock, southern rock band Molly Hatchet. And I think we might be seeing now the rise of the peacemakers in the Middle East. Some stunning news I wanted to get to tonight that happened this week, just a couple of days ago. It's remarkable when you think about it. It was announced that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have agreed to normalize relations. They haven't been anywhere near there at any point in time. This is remarkable, truly, because it is historic and it is unprecedented. And President Trump and his administration, Jared Kushner and others, have done a tremendous feat here as they have really focused on bringing peace to the Middle East with their own Middle Eastern peace plan. And having these dialogues happen and recognizing there's a common enemy, Iran, and common economic ties and more that are needed to, that they need to continue fostering and not set aside. And that has been bringing these countries together. Now it's being reported that two other Middle Eastern countries, Gulf Arab countries, Oman and Bahrain, may be next in normalizing relations, achieving peace with Israel. And who knows where we can go from there. To talk about this, I am so pleased to be joined by two dear friends of mine, former Ambassador Bahrain from 1986 to 1989, Sam Zakim. And of course, he also was called back by President George H.W. Bush to assist with the diplomatic effort in the first Gulf War. And also Samuel Lurie, who's a fellow at the Centennial Institute and has done work as a fellow for the Millennial Policy Center, which for some time I spearheaded. And I'm so pleased to welcome you both to the show. It's good to have you back.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's a pleasure, as always, to be with you, and especially with Samuel, too.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you, and especially a great honor to be with Ambassador Zakim.
So this truly is a historic achievement on the part of the Trump administration, Israel, the United Arab Emirates. So many different aspects have been at play here in terms of reaching this kind of a peace accord. Ambassador Zakim, what are your reactions and what can you tell us? What do we know so far about what has been achieved between Israel and the UAE?
I am so happy, so thankful to God that after 72 years of hate, of distrust, of wars, of people hating each other on both sides now, due to the leadership of our president and the leadership in the UAE of Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, we are witnessing a miracle. Only God could have brought it, other than Mr. Trump and Sheikh Mohammed. Thank God that it is coming. It's due. After 72 years, and as you eloquently stated, and as Samuel and the three of us have spoken in the past, it's about time, and it's going to usher a new era of peace, of understanding, and good relationship among the peoples of the Middle East, the whole Middle East.
Ambassador, one of the things that seems to be a term, one of the terms agreed upon between Israel and the UAE to make this happen is that Israel has said that they will not continue to move forward with the plan to annex the West Bank. How significant is that in your mind?
Very significant, especially for Israel itself. Israel is a Jewish state. If it does not include all kinds of people who are not Jewish, and especially it is good for the Druze, who make up a good portion of the armed forces of Israel, and who love Israel and have served Israel so well. And it's going to encourage Bahrain, and as you stated, and Oman to be next in line. And I, as a former citizen of Lebanon, I wish Lebanon would be even the first to acknowledge Israel and conclude a peace treaty with Israel and exchange ambassadors with Israel.
Samuel Lurie, fellow in Israel and Middle Eastern Affairs at the Centennial Institute. What's your reaction to this momentous achievement this week?
Well, I think it's a tremendous accomplishment. It's very historic, as Ambassador Zakim said it. I thank God that after all these years, these people that have, there's been conflict in this part of the world for so long, unfortunately, between the Israelis and the Palestinians and others in that region. And I think this was really the fruition of 3.5 years of President Trump, Jared Kushner, the whole administration working very hard behind the scenes. They were very tight-lipped and did a very good job at, not letting it spill out for the press to, report on it or anything, but they were able to pull this off. And I think it shocked a lot of people, but it's just an incredible testament. I think, Israel and the UAE are two of the strongest countries in the Middle East. They're commercial centers, economic centers, military centers as well. And I think, hopefully the UAE is just first through the door and we're going to see more of the Gulf states. And I'm just very proud that you, me, and Ambassador Zakim wrote about this rapprochement, months and months ago. And it's amazing to see it beginning to come to pass.
Yeah, Samuel Lurie, one of the things that you're referencing this, you and I were co-authors on a paper and project for the Millennial Policy Center about achieving peace and prosperity in the Middle East. By the way, website's still up, millennialpolicycenter.org. If folks want to go check it out on the homepage, you just click Strengthening America's Position in the World. We really delved in and detailed this, and Ambassador Zakim kindly advised us in this effort and also was party to a documentary, short documentary that we put together on this. But before I go back to the ambassador, can you lay out for us, Samuel Lurie, the essence of what the Trump administration's strategy has been in the Middle East that really helped to bring this about?
Really, I think what encapsulates the strategy best is a phrase I've heard Jason Greenblatt, who was a senior advisor in the administration, use, and I've heard many others use this as well, but an outside-in approach, where instead of trying to first solve the Israeli Palestinian conflict, they focused on strengthening the relations that were already developing between Israel and the Gulf Arab states. Once the Obama administration had signed the Iran nuclear deal, these countries just realized it was in their best interest to put their hostilities behind them, to start collaborating on containing the threat of a nuclear Iran, on an Iran that funds terrorism across the region, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other proxy terrorist organizations. So they found that mutual benefit there. And they also found a mutual benefit in trade and in commerce and investment. And so, that's really been the essence. They've worked behind the scenes to try to strengthen the relations between Israel and these Gulf Arab countries. And I really think that it's going to completely reshape the landscape, the geopolitical landscape of the Middle East for years to come.
Ambassador Zakim, can you speak to what Samuel Lurie is discussing and offer some insights on how you view the Trump administration's approach in the Middle East, what the administration identified and how they decided to go about pursuing peace in the Middle East in a way that is different from previous presidents and policymakers?
I would say 100% I support what Samuel had said. Mr. Trump had the insight and the courage to enter into this area where nobody had succeeded before. And he is a man of his word. He gave Jerusalem back to Israel, the Golan Heights. He promised economic support for the Palestinians. And it's a great vision on the part of our president and Mr. Kushner, who is in charge of the Near East at the White House. May I also give great credit to Sheikh Mohammed Bin Zayed, the crown prince of the UAE.
Of course.
This year, he built the Abrahamic Center in Abu Dhabi, which had a mosque, a church, and a synagogue. Mm. The Abrahamic Center. This is the beauty of Sheikh Mohammed, and I got in touch with him, and I congratulated him through the embassy, through Ambassador Youssef Al-Arteba of the UAE, for the great step forward. It's about time. It's about time. Enough war is enough. Enough hatred is enough. Let peace come to the Abrahamic people. They're all Semites over there, and they should love each other rather than dwell on hate and hatred and conflict.
Samuel Lurie, let me get back to you on the subject of the Trump administration strategy here, because it truly is striking that what they decided to do was not get Israel and the Palestinians into a room together, as had been tried unsuccessfully before in previous presidencies. But instead, let's go to these other countries and try to mend fences with Israel, because that will send a message to the Palestinians. Hey, you need to get your act together, because we're starting to see these Arab countries have the rapprochement, as you've been talking about, with Israel, and they're getting on board. You need to. Now, this is the first country of the UAE. It looks like Oman and Bahrain will follow. Who knows when we might get to, for example, Saudi Arabia, which has already been at least opening up some dialogue and conversations with Israel, which has been remarkable, including the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman visiting Israel a few years ago to meet in Tel Aviv with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So talk to us a little bit more about that and how it can actually work and has been actually working, as we're seeing in the Middle East right now.
I think Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it best, and I think this is a sentiment that President Trump and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed share as well, that peace is established from a place of strength. It's not established from a place of concessions and making both sides have to make concessions. But Israel came from a place of strength. It did give the concession of, you know, holding off on any new settlements or annexation or anything like that. In the West Bank, which was important for the UAE. But ultimately, these are two very strong countries coming together who realized it was in their best interest to cooperate. And I think, you know, other administrations missed some of the secret back channels that had been developing between Israel and the GCC, the Gulf Council countries. And really, this is a new approach, and it hadn't been tried before. And I think President Trump, as a businessman, as a deal maker, just realized the Iran nuclear deal was a very bad deal. And he realized the U.S.'s strongest allies in the region, the Arabs and Israel, you know, that how bad this was for them. And why would you make a deal that so badly disadvantages your friends? And so they found a way to broker, to work behind the scenes, to put together this Abraham Accord, they're calling it, which I love, because it's, you know, bringing together Jews and Arabs and all the children of Abraham. So I think really this is a monumental deal. It's a new paradigm. You and I talked about the new Middle East paradigm in our paper, and just all the shifting dynamics at play. But that's just a little bit of it, is bringing these countries together from a place of strength that have shared interests economically, national security, so many different areas. And it's great to see it happening.
Former Ambassador to Bahrain, Sam Zakim, let me ask you about Samuel's point regarding some of these back channel conversations. There is a report from the Wall Street Journal yesterday that was talking about how more than a quarter century of deepening but largely secret business and security ties between the two countries, that is Israel and the UAE, were happening, were underway, and that helped to signal this shift to in the Middle East to greater peace. And what we've noticed, I think, is that what we're seeing now is that the Trump administration and President Trump and Jared Kushner and others in their team have identified, to Samuel's point, these back channel conversations that have been going on for years and decided to really help to move those forward, to keep them going and to foster stronger relationships among these countries, getting to this point, which is interesting because Barack Obama didn't seem to identify any of those back channels. Or if he did, he didn't seem to care about it because he was obsessed with placating Iran, which, of course, helped to tick off the Arab countries who felt like the United States was leaving them behind while focusing on Iran. And interestingly enough, one of the other things that President Trump identified was the threat of Iran being a shared threat among the Gulf Arab states and Israel. So I said a lot there, but what are your thoughts, sir?
I love what you said, and you explained it so well. This is a great day for not just for Israel and its Arab neighbors. It's a great day for the United States of America, having realized that the previous administration had been so anti-American in the course that it carried on with Iran. The Obama administration was a fiasco for our national interest in that part of the world. And thank God for the leadership of Mr. Trump. We are reestablishing ourselves as the leaders of that whole region and the whole world. And just imagine, on both sides, they look up to the United States. There was a time during the Obama administration where they distrusted us so much because of Obama's support for the troublemaker in that region, which is Iran and Hezbollah. What has happened now is reestablishing the greatness and the authority of the United States as the main world leader, especially in that region of the world.
And Ambassador Zakim, what do you think is the likelihood that we might get to a point where Saudi Arabia is added to the list of countries that have decided to normalize relations with Israel? Because when I recently interviewed, I've done two interviews with the spokesman for the Saudi embassy, the official spokesperson, Fahad Nazir, and the first interview I asked him about thawing relations with Israel, and he said, we have no relations with Israel, which is, of course, the official position. But is there a time we could see in the future, especially if President Trump is reelected, where Saudi Arabia actually does say, yes, we have relations with Israel?
I am very hopeful that under the leadership of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, this is going to happen. Jimmy and Samuel, you both thought so too, and the three of us agree on this, that God willing, Mohammed bin Salman is going to come out and say enough is enough. We are both Semites. We are the children of Abraham. We're the children of one God, and we're going to have peace and fight hate with love rather than with more hate, and be tolerant of each other and be respectful of the rights and the freedom of the Jewish people to live in peace in Jerusalem and in Israel.
Just a few minutes left with our guests, Ambassador Sam Zakim, who was Ambassador to Bahrain from 1986 to 1989, and Samuel Lurie, who is fellow in Israel and Middle Eastern Affairs at the Centennial Institute, and also co-author of a paper on this exact topic of Middle East peace and achieving peace in the Middle East for the Millennial Policy Center, with yours truly, Jimmy Sangenberger. Samuel, just a final question for you, and then I want to ask Ambassador Zakim briefly about Lebanon. Anything else that you want to add that you think we should be watching for in moving forward?
Lebanon needs the international community, needs help, financial help, badly. I hope the listeners, would whoever is listening to this program, would be kind enough and generous enough to send some donations to the Lebanese people, who are really in terrible economic shape. They are, the banks have do not lend any money. The banks do not even give them their own money from their own deposits. The dollar has moved from 1,500 Lebanese pounds to 10,000 Lebanese pounds. So, and everything they buy is in dollars. And the Lebanese people are in very, very bad shape, and I hope the international community will lend a hand.
And I've got a follow-up question on that in just a moment, Ambassador. But, Samuel, any further thoughts on the achievements this week by the Trump administration, Israel, United Arab Emirates, and what's to come?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we should definitely look for more developments, as we've already said. You know, Oman and Bahrain could be next. Other Gulf Arab states could be next. I think there's just a great courage in a lot of these Arab leaders to step forward and to make peace with Israel. This is the right time. And, you know, Jared Kushner was recently talking about how a lot of these citizens would love to have the ability to fly to Israel, to travel, to do business in Israel, to invest in the high tech and healthcare companies that Israel has some of the best in the world, some of the best in the Middle East. I mean, Israel has all kinds of solutions in its economy for surrounding countries, and they would greatly benefit from, you know, the capital that these Arab Gulf states could bring to the table. And so I think we'll see more of that. And, you know, obviously their citizens would also like to be able to visit the holy sites there in Jerusalem and in Israel. And so I think we're going to live through a new era of seeing these people coming into Jerusalem and people worshiping side by side that we just never thought that this would be possible. But I think we're in the very beginning stages of it.
And Ambassador Sam Zakim, just a final question relative to Lebanon. What do you think, especially with the political disarray, the resignation of the government there, what do you think Lebanon's role may end up being in what we're seeing as far as fostering greater peace in the Middle East?
Well, the Lebanese people have traditionally been very resilient. They have lived through numerous civil wars. They have lived under occupation of the Ottoman Empire, and they were a protectorate of the French government after World War I. They will live. They have faith in God. They are deeply religious. Both the Muslims as well as the Christians. And the beauty of what's happening now, if there is anything beautiful there, is that those who are going on the street to peacefully demonstrate against the corruption in government, they are carrying one flag and one flag alone. It's the Lebanese flag, the cedar tree.
It is remarkable.
And it used to be each one sang for his own what religious beliefs, and they were so badly divided. Now the people are united, asking for reforms and standing against corruption.
And hopefully, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're out of time here, but hopefully that will help to lead as well to a relationship with Lebanon and Israel like we're seeing with the UAE now. Samuel Lurie with the Centennial Institute and former Ambassador of Bahrain, Sam Zakim. We're out of time, gentlemen, but thank you both so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Samuel.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Ambassador. Pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. That's it for the first hour. Two more up ahead on the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS.